From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. It's been 1 year since a gunman opened fire at Pulse, the nightclub near downtown Orlando, which was frequented by the LGBT community. The deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history claimed 49 lives and left dozens more wounded. The loss sent shockwaves across the nation and around the globe and transformed the city of Orlando at its core. Today on Gulf Coast Live, we are dedicating our entire hour to a special look at how the shooting has impacted the community. Working with our colleagues at WMFE in Orlando, we'll hear from survivors of the shooting, we'll remember those who were lost, and we'll look at some of the many ways the community of Orlando has responded, then, now, and with an eye toward the future. And we'll examine how things have changed since those early morning hours of June 12, 2016. The special program Pulse, 1 year later, begins after the news. Today, Gulf Coast Live is bringing you a one-hour show marking 1 full year since the terrorist shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. This special program is called Pulse 1 Year Later, and it's being heard on WGCU today thanks to the efforts of the reporters, producers, and more at Orlando's public radio station, WMFE. Here to lead us through this program is Nicole Darden-Creston.
This is Pulse 1 Year Later. As a news organization, 90.7 WMFE has a responsibility to acknowledge and mark the passing of 1 year since the tragic shooting at Pulse nightclub that claimed 49 lives, left dozens more wounded, and had such a profound and lasting effect on our community. But as a newsroom made up of individuals who call Orlando home, we know what our neighbors know— that the events of June 12th's early morning hours are already seared into our memories, that there's less to be gained from revisiting or reanalyzing the timeline of those events, and more to learn from each other. So we're focusing this special program on the stories of people, people who survived and how they're moving forward, people who were lost and how they're remembered, and people here and around the world who were moved to respond in the wake of the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history that happened 1 year ago today on our doorstep. We begin by hearing from survivors. I checked in on Amanda Grau. She was one of many who hid in a bathroom as the initial gunfire erupted, then was trapped during the 3 hours that gunman Omar Mateen terrorized people inside the club. She was shot multiple times. Over the past year, she's worked to recover from her injuries, even heading back to her job as a certified nursing assistant in late February.
The first blow that I received was underneath my arm, and also the second blows and third and fourth were my right leg, my ankle, and then also another shot to my back. So when I had gotten to Orlando Hospital, I had to have three surgeries underneath my arm, nothing on my legs because it went straight through. I had to get a graft done, so they had to clean out the debris for the first surgery out of my arm. And then the second one, I had to go back and they had to put a pump underneath my arm that suctions all the, I guess, the old blood, I should say. Then my third and final one was to go and get the graft done, which they took a piece of skin from my right thigh, and that's what I have underneath my armpit as of right now.
Where has the shooting and the reaction to it left you with your faith in the world, in humanity?
I try to still think of a positive outlook on things and society. I don't hate the world or anything like that or think anything like that. I thank God every day that I was able to make it and to still be here with my family. I just hope that one day that we all can, hopefully we can wake up and just come together and just be kind and love and show each other kindness.
Amanda Grout, what can Orlando do for you? Is there anything?
I would ask them to still continue to be strong, to show kindness, love, peace, and just to remember the people that lost their lives and the ones that were injured, and just to keep their families in their prayers.
What are you looking forward to, Amanda? Any specific goals or dreams that you'd like to share with us?
Yes, I am. I'm looking forward to finally getting to marry the love of my life, Elizabeth. We have a date, December 16th of this year. And then as far as after that, I'm looking forward to going to Tokyo for my daughter's 16th birthday next year in the summer. We were supposed to do it this past year, but, I wanted to get better and also get better so I was able to walk down the aisle as well. I'm looking forward to eventually going back to school as well.
Amanda Grau, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Also hiding in the Pulse bathroom that night was Orlando Torres. When the gunman came in, Orlando curled up on his side on top of a toilet to try to keep his feet from showing under the stall. But in the chaos, someone who'd been shot tried to push into the stall as well, and Orlando fell to the floor. He remembers feeling the shooter touch his back with the tip of a gun, not knowing if he would live or die.
I lost many friends. I've lost close to 15 friends that tragic evening, and also friends that I didn't even know they were in the next bathroom stall that I was in the restroom.
Orlando Torres' story was part of WMFE's Spanish podcast project called Orlando, Un Año Después, or Orlando, 1 Year Later. Two of the collaborators on this project were 90.7's Crystal Chavez and founder of the Orlando Latino blog, Maria Padilla. She's also former editor of El Sentinel. Let's start with you, Crystal. You interviewed Orlando Torres for your podcast on Latin Night. What is Latin Night like in Orlando a year after Pulse?
Yes, Latin Night, I went out to Parliament House Thursday night when they have their Latin Night. There was a lot of people. It wasn't super packed, but I did speak to many of the patrons, many of them who said, we got to keep living life and we're not going to let Pulse stop us from going out with friends and family and celebrating birthdays and such. Now, they did talk about how they are a lot more vigilant now and aware and look for the exits and watching out, but they're not letting it stop them. And people are starting to get back out again. Though there are some survivors who to this day still haven't gone back out, and that's understandable.
Tell us a little more about the other themes explored in the Spanish podcasts, Crystal.
So we looked at mental health. We looked at, Hispanic family counseling. They have added more counselors, more than double. I believe they had 22 and now they have something like 47 counselors. There's been a lot of grants going down to fund bilingual culturally competent counseling for people who are Latinx, LGBT, and Latino. Some of the other podcasts we did, one was StoryCorps, and it's heart-wrenching, and the way that StoryCorps is, people remembering Luis Daniel Wilson, one of the 49 victims. We talked about law enforcement who and the media who were the first responders to this tragedy. And religion, which is Maria Padilla's podcast.
Maria Padilla, you focused on an Orlando evangelical church with a primarily Latino congregation, and the pastor from this church participated in the citywide prayer service after Pulse.
That's correct. We interviewed Pastor Nino Gonzalez of El Calvario Church off of Oak Ridge Road. They are probably the largest Latino evangelical congregation in Orlando area. They have about 4,000 members. And they were pretty prominent during the crisis. I think one of the things that struck me that he said during our podcast is that it was important for El Calvario and probably other churches as well to not further stigmatize the LGBT community that had already been stigmatized because of the shooting and even perhaps attitudes beforehand. And that's why they became a little bit more active and vocal during this whole time.
Maria, what are some of the areas of common ground that have come out of the LGBT and religion discussions after the tragedy?
I don't know if there's so much common ground as sort of opening of ground to a certain extent, which is to say that perhaps we had communities that weren't really in dialogue, and now... they are. some of that has been touch and go, to be honest. It has not been continual. And in the case of El Calvario, I think they kind of fell out of it a little bit, which he admits.
Crystal Maria, what do you two hope this project accomplishes?
A few things. First, for people to take note of a large and growing segment of our population. One thing, at Orlando Regional Medical Health, one of our interns, her podcast looked at how there was a lack of translators for family members, and you had family members translating for other family members. And so that's something their ORMC is working on, and working on getting people maybe a vest that says they are Spanish speakers. So there are little concrete things like that that can happen. But also, I just hope that we serve an underserved community.
We have to also remember, if I may add a few things here, that this event, this massacre did occur on Latin night. And that is why we have such a very large number of Latinos who were victims and also survivors, because it was a night in which Pulse set aside every week to draw Latino patrons to the club. As Crystal says, the podcast is in Spanish, which automatically removes a barrier for a lot of people who may want to hear it in their own language. They may know and read about it here and there, but here we are trying to tell them the story 1 year later in Spanish. So we've kind of removed or reduced that barrier for them.
That was Maria Padilla, founder of the Orlando Latino blog, and 90.7's Crystal Chavez, talking about their Spanish podcast, Orlando, Un Año Después.
Somos uno en un planeta. Somos uno.
This is Pulse, 1 year later.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Florida poet laureate Peter Meinke wrote a poem to mark 1 year since the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. 49 people died after a gunman opened fire inside the gay nightclub on June 12th last year. Catherine Welsh from sister station WMFE talked with Meinke about his poem, which he recites here.
How did you prepare your mind to write a poem about such a well-known tragedy?
One of the things I like about different definitions of poetry, my favorite is poetry is the emotional history of the world. And I wanted to get at the emotion. I had all this stuff about the details of it. I wanted to get deeper into it. And I didn't want to, and what I was writing was seemed too like an outsider, or someone who's angry about it as I was, and someone who was preaching. And so eventually I began writing from inside, and it worked out finally with some of the lines I saw they could be written by a survivor. And so that's sort of the point of view, which becomes clear as you go through the poem.
As listeners prepare to hear your poem, what do you want them to capture? What do you want them to take away from this poem?
I really want the reader to come away with how serious and how unyielding these terrible tragedies are. And would then try harder to avoid them and do everything we can to avoid these terrorist attacks, to avoid war, perhaps. This could be an anti-war poem for all that.
Peter Meinke, you're Florida's poet laureate. Your poem is titled 1 Year Later. Could you please read us your poem?
Yes, I'd be glad to. Time passes, sleep ravels, a smile might start. The mind can weasel out of any trap, but there's no real healing of the heart. A sour automatic can tear apart a face or year, pealing like a thunderclap. Still, time passes, sleep ravels, smiles can start. She sang each morning. He ran our supermart. Each memory stings sharper than a slap. How can there be a healing of the heart? Our blood slows, sickened by a poison dart. My blue bird, my beau, when you nestled by my lap, time passed, sleep unraveled, sly smiles might start. Now, time's tipped over like a broken cart that carries nothing forward, not a scrap, nothing much to heal in an empty heart. And what of kindness, mercy, music, art? Oh, how we all could dance, tango and tap. Time passes, sleep ravels, a smile can start. But there's no real healing for a stricken heart.
Peter Meinke, your poem titled One Year Later, marking 1 year since the Pulse nightclub shooting. Peter, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I'm glad to do it.
That was Orlando reporter Catherine Welsh speaking with Florida's poet laureate Peter Meinke, who performed his poem called 1 Year Later. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live, and today we're sharing a one-hour special marking 1 year since the Pulse nightclub shooting.
This is the special program, Pulse, 1 year later. Doctors and nurses at Orlando Regional Medical Center say they experienced firsthand a flaw in the healthcare system. When a lot of people are hurt at once, the closest hospital gets the most patients. As 90.7's health reporter A. Babaraya finds, that stressed the hospital to its limit.
9 patients died the morning of June 12th at Orlando Regional Medical Center. The dead were lined up in the decontamination area outside the trauma bay while healthcare workers tried to save the ones who could be saved. There was a moment when nurse Libby Brown realized how bad the Pulse nightclub shooting had been.
We didn't have a sheet to cover up a patient that was deceased that was just going to go be lined up with other bodies. So that was one of the times that I was like, this is very, very bad.
It was utter chaos that morning. Nurses were running up to the blood bank in the hospital, bringing buckets of blood by hand back to the trauma bay. During a trauma, they used pressurized IV bags to pump blood into patients faster, but they were all being used, so nurses were literally standing at the head of the bed, squeezing blood into people by hand. Elizabeth Burroughs is an ER nurse as well.
There was somebody coming at some point that there were people with gunshot wounds to the chest sitting in the hallway, gaping wounds where they're sitting on the floor because we don't have stretchers, so we kind of systematically went through and started trying to figure out how could we best help these people.
And if that wasn't bad enough, things got worse. Police got the call that there were shots fired at ORMC. This is from body camera footage recently released.
Just have more team here, gunshots in the area of ORMC.
Did you hear that? Gunshots in the area of ORMC now.
No one is exactly sure why they thought there was a shooter at the hospital. Maybe someone heard the shots being fired 3 blocks down the road and thought it was happening at the hospital. Maybe one of the patients panicked. Regardless of why it happened, at 3:19 a.m., the call came out. There was a shooter inside the ER at Orlando Regional Medical Center. Police drove over to the hospital, guns drawn. The hospital was put on lockdown as police followed a trail of blood. They eventually handcuffed one of the victims, who had the same style facial hair as the shooter. In the body cam footage, healthcare workers are seen crossing paths with police in the halls of the hospital.
We know we're still on lockdown, right? I know. We're still on lockdown. We're going to the ED.
Yeah.
Straight hall, straight down there and stay. All right, get out of the halls.
But healthcare workers continued caring for patients as police were looking for an active shooter. Dr. Chad Smith was a trauma surgeon working in the ER that night.
You know, I tell the story of one of our interns that took a patient to the operating room during the code silver, and this patient was dying, and she rolled the patient out there and did her job to take the patient to the operating room, thinking that she could be shot, you know, and not just in the trauma bay, but rolling down the hall, into the elevator, etc.
Smith remembers co-workers texting their loved ones, but still working on patients. There was no shooter, but combined with the overwhelming number of patients, the morning of June 12th was the hardest shift of their lives. A. Babaraya, 90.7 News.
Feel my pulse. With your hand on my heart, you know it beats just as hard as yours. Feel my pulse. Oh. God, I'm just the same as you are, so just feel my pulse.
That song is one of the innumerable works of art created after the shooting. In the face of incomprehensible tragedy, people often look for answers, for some way to help, or at least for solace in art. That's according to Jim Helsinger, artistic director of the Orlando Shakespeare Theater, and the man behind perhaps the most visible symbol of artistic community response, the Angel Action Wings. 10-foot wingspan made of white fabric and PVC piping. Helsinger and an army of volunteers first created and wore the wings to protect mourners at a Pulse victim's funeral from protesters who'd flown in from Kansas to picket across the downtown Orlando street.
There were easily 1,000 people on those two city blocks, all holding banners in support of the people that we had lost and in support of Orlando and its unity and its pride. And that was incredibly moving. So it was everybody and us standing directly across from the Westboro Baptist Church. And they began chanting hateful things, so we started singing. And we sang, "What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love." And that feeling of love on one side of two city blocks from Orlando and hatred from the other corner was just an incredible experience of how love can conquer hate.
Were there a couple of moments that stood out to you that you'd like to share with us?
I remember there had been a lull, and they started yelling again. I was standing next to Michael Wanzi, who's a leader in the gay community here, and they started shouting something particularly terrible. And I held his hand, and he held mine, and we started singing Amazing Grace together. And I've probably never in my life known that I was in the right place at the right time doing the right thing to help others than that moment. So that was that experience of the counter protest.
Jim Helsinger, the angels wore the wings at the funeral of Drew Linehan. What did you hear from his family and friends afterwards?
The thank you for being here, which we heard from many members of the crowd, was amazing. Drew's family went down a different street and around, so they were able to avoid it completely. But there were about 300 or 400 mourners who all came down that street. So at one point they said, "We want you to part to either side so the mourners can come by." So the angels and the hundreds of counter-protesters, we parted sides, again blocking the Westboro Baptist Church. And then hundreds of these people kept walking by us. And that's how it was really intended to work, so that they could get to the funeral without having to walk by these shouts of hate and everything about you and your life is wrong and God hates you, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think anyone, any friend, family member, or acquaintance wants to hear that God hates someone when they're on the way to their funeral.
How has the experience with these angel wings changed you? What has stayed with you?
I've been in the theater almost my whole life. I love theater. I love how it speaks to the soul. But I've never seen it do anything as powerful as this. I've never seen its function as social action in this way.
Jim Helsinger is the artistic director of the Orlando Shakespeare Theater. This is Pulse, 1 year later. You're listening to the special program, Pulse, 1 year later. Here in Orlando, we have a profound sense of lingering effects from the Pulse nightclub shooting. Those who were directly affected grapple with long recoveries, difficult memories, post-traumatic stress. Some of that hurt is felt by the larger community. And yet, we also see signs of a city showing a new degree of solidarity with its LGBTQ members. But here in Orlando, we're in the eye of the storm, and it's hard to see the impact of Pulse from a larger perspective. Dan Savage has that insight. He's a columnist, the voice of the Savage Lovecast, and the founder of the It Gets Better Project, a group that offers support to LGBTQ youth.
There's something about social media and the way social media puts us all in one place all at one time. And I lived through the worst days of the AIDS epidemic in the gay community. And one of the things that kind of was upsetting was people being grief vultures, claiming grief and pain that wasn't their own. And so I don't want to suggest that that's what's going on here, but I really do feel like everyone felt present in Orlando and impacted directly because of the way we live on social media. Less directly, and I think with less impact than, of course, people who were there and people who were, you know, geographically more closely situated and felt more personally threatened. But I really feel like everyone all across the country, I think that's one of the reasons you saw this response. Everyone felt that this was close by, that this was nearby, that we were virtually there. And that's the power of social media. And it I think, created feelings of empathy, not just in the Orlando community for the victims, and or in the Orlando community for Orlando, but across the country for the victims and for Orlando.
The role that clubs play in the LGBT community is sometimes one of a safe space. And we're hearing that people shied away from the clubs here in Orlando after the shooting. Based on what you're hearing, did the shooting make members of the LGBT community outside Orlando feel less safe going out to the clubs? Was there a violation of that feeling of having a safe and comfortable place to be?
Absolutely. I had friends here in Seattle who were afraid to go out, afraid of some lunatic with easy access to a gun deciding to be a copycat mass murderer. So yeah, people were nervous and afraid. People also felt then, I think, compelled to go out, to confront their fears and to not be cowed. We also had another incident in Seattle a few years ago where someone threatened to attack people in the bars. And the response of the community was for everyone, including members of our city council, to go on a gay bar crawl one night and to fill up the bars and show that we weren't afraid. But paradoxically, those moments where you go out to show you're not afraid, you're actually confronting and staring down your fears. You are afraid, and you're going out despite those fears.
Has it raised the LGBT community's profile, in your opinion?
Yes, and it's a tragedy that it takes a tragedy. You know, it took the brutal killing of Matthew Shepard for people to start discussing hate crimes in relationship to LGBT people. It took the HIV/AIDS epidemic for people to see gay love for what it was, the equivalent of, and as deeply felt and as meaningful as straight love. It takes something like Orlando for people to realize that the people in queer bars, the lesbian, gay, bi, trans, Latina people at Pulse are human beings, not just abstractions, not just these cliches, but human beings with families. And in a way, that's what the AIDS epidemic did. People were dying, and it wasn't just gay people who were being impacted. It was straight people, straight friends, straight family members who were being devastated by the losses. And what Orlando demonstrated, what these deaths demonstrated, was that queer people aren't living on an island all unto themselves. The queer people come from straight communities, straight families, and we're knit into the wider community. And when you rip out, as the HIV/AIDS epidemic did, hundreds of thousands of us, or you take out 50 of us in one community, quickly what you see is that queer people are important, that queer people are loved, and that queer people are not in a silo labeled queer all by themselves, that we are part of our communities. And that's why the wider Orlando community was so devastated by this attack.
Do you think with what's happened, the LGBT community has a role to play in gun control? And if so, what is that role, or what do you think it should be?
Obviously, we all have a role to play in demanding sane gun control policies. And the LGBT community absolutely has a role to play. You know, there are times when a tragedy gives you a platform and you want to not seem exploitative or not seem exploited, or not feel exploited, but you want to seize those opportunities to, in the wake of a tragedy, create progress on a difficult issue like gun control. And I was thrilled and heartened to see so many queer people stepping up and making the battle for sane gun control policies their battle in the wake of the Pulse massacre.
What struck you the most about the response to the shooting? Was there a singular moment, or was there a broad, overarching concept? What struck you the most?
Just the tsunami of love and support that you saw pour forth, and the stories that were told, and stories that were told in the wake of it that aren't often told about queer people of color who are often overlooked or not included in the narrative about queer lives. That was what really struck me. In the wake also of Pulse, what you saw was, you saw the whole community come out and say, this happened to all of us, because queer people are a part of our community too. They are part of the us. And so you can see glimmers of the progress even in the giant dark cloud of the event itself. Those glimmers of progress can give us the strength and hope to get out there and fight and create the change that needs to be created to make a better world, not just for queer people, but for all people.
What do you want to say to members of Orlando's LGBT community and those who were at Pulse who may be listening to this?
I'm not sure that I want to say much. I think it's our job to listen to the Orlando community and to listen to people who were at Pulse and who witnessed it, survived it, and are still, I'm sure, processing the grief and coming to a deeper understanding of it and of themselves and the meanings of it. And so I think at this point I've been speaking for a while, and at this point maybe my job is to shut up and listen.
Dan Savage, syndicated columnist, voice of the podcast, The Savage Love Cast, and founder of the It Gets Better Project, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the special program, Pulse, 1 year later. As of today, June 12, 2017, Pulse Nightclub still stands, closed, surrounded by fences covered with artwork and a year-old makeshift memorial. What does the future hold for the site of the nightclub? 90.7's Amy Green says the club's owner wants to give mourners a space and plans a permanent memorial and museum at Pulse.
Not far from downtown Orlando, the Pulse nightclub sits silently as cars whiz by and mourners examine the artwork, candles and flowers left with care on the hot pavement out front. Jim Marshall is from Seattle.
That's the value to me of coming here. I can move through a lot of the sadness and the anger and move into that place of love and gratitude and experience this very sacred hollow place. It's a blessing.
Marshall slouches on a yellow strip that once marked a parking space at the gay nightclub as he surveys the scene. A screen featuring the rainbow-colored murals of local artists hangs from a chain-link fence surrounding the club. It serves as a happy shroud for the carcass of a building, which is painted black, as it always was. This is the outpouring that inspired Pulse owner Barbara Poma's plans for memorial and museum. The project would be modeled after ones marking acts of terrorism in New York City and Oklahoma City.
I've handed the property over and the project over to our families and survivors and everyone here in Orlando and the world.
She established two groups of survivors, family members, and others touched by the tragedy to oversee the process. Her One Pulse Foundation will fund the effort. Eventually, she'll solicit bids from designers.
We have no idea how long it's going to take. You don't know if it's going to be 1 year, 3 years, 5 years. And I think putting a time on it is unrealistic, and it could create pressure, unnecessary pressure for a lot of people, especially the families, because since our process is starting so, you know, within the 1 year mark, some people aren't ready yet.
Ken Foote, author of the book Shadowed Ground, America's Landscapes of Violence and Tragedy, says only within the last generation has there been a need to learn from these acts and honor the dead.
These memorials for these horrible shootings and so forth are relatively new. People seem to think that we've always done this sort of thing, but the sense of shame that's often attached to these events often in the past made it very difficult for people to mark these events.
Myra Alvear always knew she would be involved. Her 25-year-old daughter Amanda was among those slain at Pulse. Amanda chillingly Snapchatted the attack, sending around the world the fast-tempo percussive sounds of the gunman's deadly fire.
My daughter died there. Why would I not be involved? That's, you know, she is my priority. Everything that has to do with my daughter, I'd be there. That's my baby.
Myra envisions a place of beauty and peace at Pulse with trees.
My daughter's life was taken there and so many others. And somehow when I visit there, it's just like the angels embrace me. Somehow it's just I feel their love, you know, it's just a feeling I have. And I don't want that feeling to go away.
A year after an act of hate, she wants to provide a space of love. Amy Green, 90.7 News. This is the special program, Pulse, 1 year later. I'm Nicole Darden-Creston.
This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. You're listening to the special program Pulse, 1 year later, produced by WMFE in Orlando and broadcast today during Gulf Coast Live. Today in Orlando, a somber day of love and support is planned to mark the one-year anniversary of the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history. Earlier, we heard from Pulse owner Barbara Poma about her plans to convert the site of the nightclub into a permanent memorial and museum. Reporter Amy Green spoke with her about what's on her mind as thousands converge in downtown Orlando today to remember.
I'm hoping that after a year that people are still remembering where they were when it happened, how their hearts felt when it happened, how they behaved when it happened. And I hope that that response that they gave that day, whether they gave blood, gave a hug, went to a vigil, held somebody, opened the door for someone, that however they behaved for those weeks and months after Pulse, that they continue to behave that way so that we live in a much kinder world.
How is the Pulse family doing at this point? You know, talk to us about how your former employees, what are they doing? What are they up to now?
You know, they are all still healing and trying to come to grips with the loss of Pulse and their friends. So I think that although some of them are working in different places or trying to work in other places or putting their lives back together, that none of them are over it yet. None of them have started to recover, I think, in ways that people would expect them to have. I think we're all still in a little bit of shock.
And you have been traveling in recent weeks. Tell us about some of those trips.
I was invited over to Sweden for a pride in a small town outside of Stockholm. And so I went there. So we spent a lot of time with their media as well as their community leaders and their what we would consider commissioners of those towns. And actually back in Stockholm, we did that there as well. I think one thing we learned over there is that I think the LGBT community feels the exact same way there as they do here. Although that in Sweden, their gay marriage is legal, adoption's legal, all their health care is taken care of. So there's no prejudices against them. I still think that they, still feel that way. And they're still having pride, so there must be. The purpose of going to Sweden was to say thank you to the rest of the world who stood with us and sent letters of support and love and messages to all of us. And so it was a way for us to say thank you to them and to spread our mission of love and to talk about our memorial and to talk about change.
Barbara Poma, we just had new terrorist attacks in Iran, London, and Manchester. Another mass shooting took place just a few days ago here in Orlando. From your point of view, what needs to happen to change this cycle of violence?
You know, there's probably many things that would, it's never going to be just one thing that fixes that. I think there are many things that go into it. I mean, whether it would be sensible gun control, whether it is living in a kinder world, whether it's about acceptance. I mean, there are just so many different factors into what's going to fix this, and I'm no expert in it.
That was Pulse nightclub owner Barbara Poma speaking with Orlando's Amy Green. In the years since the Pulse shooting, local chapters of a gay gun advocacy group have popped up around the country, including in Fort Myers. WGCU's Quincy Walters takes us to a meeting of the group known as the Pink Pistols.
There's a sign on a table at the local Culver's restaurant this night indicating the group is a chapter of the Pink Pistols, a nationwide organization that encourages the LGBTQ community to learn to defend itself with firearms. The emblem is an upside-down pink triangle with a figure holding a gun. Chad Hendricks, who's gay, was at the Pulse nightclub a week before the massacre. When he heard the news, he says he was angry.
Had there been people that are armed in there, it's very possible he would have been shot down like the dog that he was.
It's a civil and human right to be armed, he says, and that's why he started this chapter of the Pink Pistols here in Fort Myers. Sitting next to him is Charlie Bingham, one of its new members.
One day I was singing karaoke in a bar, and I went into the bathroom, and there was a Pink Pistols ad there. And I thought, okay, that takes a little stress out for me. Like, you know, maybe it's my own biases, but I was like, I would rather learn from a gay guy than a straight guy. It will be easier for me somehow. That was the hook for me.
Bingham identifies with the LGBTQ community, but says he's married to a woman and has a daughter. But that's the thing, says Hendricks. You don't need to be LGBTQ to be in the group.
Like we say here on our flyer, We're a single issue organization. We don't keep any databases. If you're not comfortable coming out, being out, you know, that's okay. We don't have to know any of that information.
Charlie Bingham says he became interested in guns after he became a family man.
It helped me feel like a more responsible parent and citizen. Like, this is something that a citizen should know how to do.
Debbie Patterson is sitting across the table from Hendricks and Bingham. She's straight, but says she's pro-LGBTQ and pro-gun. She says she grew up in the country, and the men in her family used guns to shoot wild animals. But she was never taught, so she's here.
When you see all the crime that is going on, and being a single woman, you need protection.
And Debbie, as a person who's not part of the LGBT community, how did you feel after the Pulse shooting?
Horrified. Horrified. Mm-hmm. First thing I did was make sure he wasn't there.
Yeah, I was at work that weekend. Yeah. So
it's terrible that the world has come to this. So. Yeah, all those people should have had a right to defend themselves in that club.
Chad Hendricks says Florida gun laws are partially to blame for people being defenseless at Pulse. If only Florida allowed concealed carry permit holders to bring guns into places that serve alcohol, he says. Other states, like Tennessee, where Hendricks lived before, allow it. You just can't drink. And he says it works.
We have designated drivers, designated shooters. You know, that way everybody's protected.
But for Pink Pistols meetings, Hendricks chose Culver's because they don't serve alcohol. Because after dinner, we head to a shooting range.
We'll load it back up again.
Chad Hendricks starts me off on a Walther P-22, a .22 caliber semi-automatic pistol. There's no recoil, but it gives you a sense for how to hold a gun. Then he gives advice on how to get a better shot.
This is what I call the fundamentals of your grip, your stance, and your presentation. So once you have all that together, then you start actually seeing results on the target.
Okay. Grip, stance,
you got to put them all together.
Right.
In order to get those.
The grip is your hand placement on the gun. Your stance is kind of how you'd bend your knees to swing a baseball bat. And your presentation is more psychological. I kind of procured a shoulders down, chest out mentality.
Well, the front side is covering.
Then Hendricks whips out a .40 caliber Glock. It's what he usually carries. It's got a laser pointer. It's what he would have carried if he were in an alternate universe where Florida allowed concealed weapons in bars and if he were at Pulse the night the shooting happened. Hendricks says law enforcement and paramedics are invaluable, but he says self-reliance is paramount to survival.
You're the first responder because you're there. The police and the ambulance and all that, they're the second responders.
But law enforcement disagrees.
A concealed weapons permit is for protection. It does not make you a first responder.
Lieutenant Jay Rodriguez is with the Fort Myers Police Department.
If there's a safe option, you get out of there. Your job is to get out of harm's way. And if the only way out of harm's way is to use that weapon that you have a license for, so be it.
Chad Hendricks says when evil decides to act like it did last year at Pulse, it's just there to do its deed, he says. And that's why he started this chapter of the Pink Pistols, to arm people with confidence to stand up to evil and say, it ends here. Quincy Walters, WGCU News.
You're listening to the special program, Pulse, 1 year later. This time belongs to the people who were at Pulse Nightclub on June 12, 2016. First, some survivors share their thoughts on the past year, what's changed for them, and where they go from here.
Just grateful to be alive because just after seeing what occurred, I don't even know how I'm alive today.
I always try to say that no matter what, everybody has a number. Everybody. And we don't know it. In history, everybody has a number. It wasn't my number that night. So you're not going to stop living life. You're not going to live in a shell.
I think it's really just me getting new experiences by going outside. That's the biggest thing. Like, I can't have a new experience by just sitting in the house processing everything. So that's really what it is.
I love this coffee shop. It has like a more home kind of feeling. It's just quiet and everybody's here and I like it.
and I consider myself very lucky to be here today.
So it's good for us to have something positive to look forward to and come together and help each other out.
I'm looking forward to finally getting to marry the love of my life, Elizabeth. We have a date, December 16th of this year. We're going to be getting married.
He intended to break my back, but he didn't break my spirit, okay?
Just live your life the way you like to live. Enjoy it with whoever you like to enjoy it with. Share it with whoever, you know. Don't let nobody take that away from you. Don't let that fear. Just keep enjoying life.
If I push forward after being in the hospital in critical condition, almost dying, whatever you're going through in your life, you can go through it. You could rise. You could get out of it. You can do it.
I'm looking forward to eventually going back to school as well, doing classes for my RN.
I've been really inspired to continue writing as far as like poetry and songwriting.
I'm a huge Harry Potter fan. So in one of the movies, Dumbledore tells Harry Potter that happiness can be found even in the darkest, you know, places, only if you remember to turn on the light.
Keep the unity going as far as the community. And when I say community, I mean the human community. So everyone of any background, just come together and be there for each other. Be a little more compassionate than we have been in the past.
So cry out, Orlando. Let your tears flow.
We heard from Amanda Grau, Angel Santiago, Jeff Xavier, Orlando Torres, Patience Carter, and Tony Marrero.
A river that leads to a sea wide and vast, an ocean of sorrow that cries out for peace at last.
Bells will ring out in Orlando and across the world 49 times in honor of the 49 lives lost 1 year ago. These are their names.
Stanley Almodovar III, 23 years old.
Amanda Alvear, 25 years old.
Oscar A. Aracena Montero, 26 years old.
Rodolfo Ayala Ayala, 33 years old.
Antonio Devon Brown, 29 years old.
Daryl Roman Burt II, 29 years old.
Angel Candelario Padro, 28 years old.
Juan Chavez Martinez, 25 years old.
Luis Daniel Conde, 39 years old.
Corey James Connell, 21 years old.
Tevin Eugene Crosby, 25 years old.
Dianca Deidre Drayton, 32 years old.
Simon Adrián Carrillo Fernandez, 31 years old.
Leroy Valentin Fernandez, 25 years old.
Mercedes Marisol Flores, 26 years old.
Peter O. Gonzalez Cruz, 22 years old.
Juan Ramon Guerrero, 22 years old.
Paul Terrell Henry, 41 years old.
Frank Hernandez, 27 years old.
Miguel Angel Honorato, 30 years old.
Javier Jorge Reyes, 40 years old.
Jason Benjamin Josephat, 19 years old.
Eddie Jamodroy Justice, 30 years old.
Anthony Luis Laureano Disla, 25 years old.
Christopher Andrew Linenen, 32 years old.
Alejandro Barrios Martinez, 21 years old.
Brenda Lee Marquez McCool, 49 years old.
Gilberto Ramon Silva Menendez, 25 years old.
Kimberly Morris, 37 years old.
Akira Monet Murray, 18 years old.
Luis Omar Ocasio Capo, 20 years old.
Geraldo A. Ortiz Jimenez, 25 years old.
Eric Ivan Ortiz Rivera, 36 years old.
Joel Rayon Paniagua, 32 years old.
Giancarlos Mendez Perez, 35 years old.
Enrique L. Rios Jr., 25 years old.
John C. Nieves Rodriguez, 27 years old.
Xavier Emanuel Serrano Rosado, 35 years old.
Christopher Joseph Sanfeliz, 24 years old.
Ilmari Rodriguez Sullivan, 24 years old.
Edward Sotomayor Jr., 34 years old.
Shane Evan Tomlinson, 33 years old.
Martin Benitez Torres, 33 years old.
Jonathan Antonio Camuy Vega, 24 years old.
Juan P. Rivera Velasquez, 37 years old.
Luis S. Vielma, 22 years old.
Frankie Jimmy De Jesus Velasquez, 50 years old.
Luis Daniel Wilson León, 37 years old.
Gerald Arthur Wright, 31 years old.
For peace, for peace at
You've been listening to Pulse, 1 year later, produced by our colleagues at WMFE in Orlando and hosted by Nicole Darden Creston. Today's show was compiled by producer Matthew Smith and director Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.